My name is David Paulson. I'm a member of the Society for American Baseball Research. Today is March 14, 2001. I'm in the home of Jane Levy in Washington, D.C. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Dave.
We will be sending a copy of this tape to the Hall of Fame, but Saber reserves the right to distribute the tape or transcripts of the interview to other researchers. Is that okay with you?
Anything that gets me into the Hall of Fame is just fine with me.
Okay. How old are you?
49.
It's okay.
Yeah, I'm still under the wire.
You'll get my maturity next year.
Yeah. And the AARP board.
Right, yeah. Where were you born?
The Bronx. In a hospital, Royal Hospital in Bronx, which no longer exists.
Were you brought up in New York?
Grew up on Long Island. But my grandmother, who I think is responsible for my passion for the New York Yankees, lived a block and a half from the stadium in a building called the Yankee Arms. And it was built in 1927, or right after, was it 27 or 29? It was during that huge building boom caused by Babe Ruth.
Well, not too many years after Yankee Stadium was, I think that was in 23.
Yankee Stadium was 23, and that whole neighborhood was being expanded. Congress Plaza, I think, opened the same year as Yankee Stadium. But anyway, she was in a building called the Yankee Arms, and it was on Walton Avenue. River Avenue's here, and then there was one more street, and then Walton Avenue. And my fantasy was that I could see the ball games from her Harlem window. Of course, it was facing the wrong direction, but that's okay. I was young and I believed.
Could you hear the stadium?
Oh, yeah,
fans?
Sure. You could hear the roar of the crowd, you could hear the crack of the bat, and you'd hear it first on the radio, and then you'd hear the echo in the streets reverberating off the building.
Plus, he had big crowds, too. It's all about 70,000.
Parking was a bitch.
Still is. Mr. Steinbrenner wants to move. One week. Okay. So you grew up in the area there.
Yes.
I guess you went to school.
I went to Barnard College and then Columbia University.
Well, not
that graduate school of journalism.
You're too.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How did you get interested in sports? Because you were so close to Yankee Stadium, or just...
I've always said that when my grandmother died, all I had left of her was the Yankees.
Was
and
she
I,
a fan?
No. No, she lived in the proximity to the stadium for the better part of her adult life and never set foot in the stadium, which astonished me. But she was very tolerant of my obsession. And I think in some psychological way, my deep and abiding affection for her was transferred to the team. It existed before she died, or after she died, you know, that's what I had left. Also, my dad was a jock with two daughters and no sons. And he needed somebody to play catch with. And I could catch. And I could throw.
I was going to say, what sports did you play? Did you play baseball or softball?
I played softball, but I thought it was a sissy game. And I wanted to play in Little League, and of course, in the unenlightened 50s, this was not a welcome addition to the squad. So they let me play, but they only let me mop up. I was a pitcher.
Oh, okay.
And so they wouldn't give me a uniform. I got a cap, but not the whole uniform. And, they don't put me in if the game was, like, completely out of control.
How'd the team do?
I have no idea.
Obviously, you didn't get too far.
No. But I played on the street all the time. I played tennis, and I swam a lot, and I competed in swimming.
Were you on some high school, or were you on the varsity team?
No, so by high school it was the 60s, and sports were as uncool and as unhip as anything could be, I was the radical in high school.
Okay, were the Yankees your favorite team?
Absolutely.
And any special players you...
Mickey. I had a fan for the Mets. I think what appealed to me in him was the prodigious what if he hadn't tripped over that keeper head in center field in 1951, what if he didn't have a diseased knees, what if he hadn't drunk so much, what if he hadn't, stayed out all night carousing with Billy Martin, what could he have done past, beyond what he did. It was something very human about people. I actually really liked him. And when I first met him, I wasn't at all convinced I was going to, I was sent to interview him by the Washington Post when I was working there in Atlantic City when I was working as a shill for one of the...
Well, he changed over the years, didn't he? He wasn't the same player that he came up
with. I think he changed from moment to moment. I mean, you know, was he different by the time he died, by the time he stood up and, you know, was a dying man and said, you know, you shouldn't do as I've done and, you know, urged people to donate organs? Surely he was changed. But when I, he was so humanly fallible. He was like a novel, like a character in a novel, more than like a baseball player. He really, the day I met him, I was so nervous. I walked up, I stuck out my hand and said, "Hi, Nick. I'm Jane Levy and I'm really nervous." And he said, "Why, do you think I was going to pull on the kitty?" And it's like, oh, no. Everything worse than fantasy. And so it started badly and it got worse. But by the end of the day and a half, 2 days, whatever it was I spent with him, I was watching this guy who was sitting in the back of a limousine. It was when one of his sons, the one named for Billy Martin, I think,
when was
it? This was 83. And I think it was Billy Martin. The kid who was named for Billy Martin had the disease that his father died from, that his mantle had died from, and that his brother, another, God knows how many of them had died, but they'd all died before they were 40, and that's why maybe he always thought he wouldn't make it to 40. And anyway, so here his kid has this disease. And he's thinking, the kid's going to die. And one of the reasons he had taken his job as the shill for the casino, which actually was in the hotel where my parents had had their very brief 1941 honeymoon, was because he needed the money for the kid's medical bills. So I had heard, I don't remember how, but the kid was sick and this had been kept hush-hush. And we're sitting in the back of the limousine, and I've got to ask this man about, you know, this kid. And I asked him a question, and he sat there, wouldn't look at me. He started to play with his hands, you know, wringing them around an imaginary bat handle. Like he reverted in that moment of incredible vulnerability and tenderness to the one thing that he could always hold on to, which is a bat. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, we're hoping he'll get okay. But I don't like to talk about it because I don't want anyone to think I'm a pussy." Like, you know, and the man was crying, you know, for his stomach. And it was so, how could you not like a guy like that? Or like
that. Now, in high school, did you do any writing, school paper, anything like that?
Yeah, but it was all about, you know, politics.
Nothing.
I was leading demonstrations.
Yeah, at that time, nothing about sports.
No. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Okay. So after high school, you went to Barnard?
Barnard College. Correct.
That's in New York.
Yes, and I studied Renaissance literature. Jousting was the only sport that came into my studies whatsoever.
Well, Maryland's a state where they have the jousting.
Yeah. I haven't been back.
Okay. So, how did you get into sports writing? Or what did you do after college?
Well, what happened was this. I was a Renaissance literature major at Barnard College, all set to go to graduate school and become a scholar in Renaissance literature. And
would that lead to a teaching?
Yeah, I figured I would get a PhD and teach. And Peter, my husband, who I knew from the time I entered college, and my mother both thought this was a terrible waste of my energy and couldn't believe I was doing this. And as I was applying to graduate school, my mother said to me, "What is it you really want to do?" And out of nowhere came the phrase, "I want to be a sports writer." And so instead of going to graduate school in English and Renaissance literature, I applied at the last minute to the journalism school at Columbia. And they took me, which is astonishing because I had no experience and my GREs really sucked.
Okay, Columbia. Columbia
University.
Oh, Columbia University.
Yeah. Columbia University. School of Journalism. Now the home of temporary home of Al Gore.
Okay.
Right.
And when would that have been about? What year?
That was in
So, okay, went to, well, you, of course you had a lot of credits, which I guess carried over from the Renaissance.
No.
Nothing carried over?
Nothing carried over. No, I started cold. My favorite story about my first day of journalism school was it was a New York City subway strike in progress at the time. And so what they did is they dragged Theodore Keel, the labor negotiator, in, who was not at that time actually negotiating for anything or anybody. So he gave a mock press conference. And we all went back on how to roll back the fare and end the strike. We all went back to our newsrooms, and which were classrooms set up as newsrooms. And the first guy, who had a job at the Boston Globe, so why he was back at journalism school, I have no clue. But the first guy, and you know his name was Dave, was done with his story and had submitted his news story by the time I set my margins. And then I made the deadline. I was very pleased with myself and the teacher. You know, like thumbing through all the stuff, and he pulls one out, and he reads the lead, and he says, "This person really needs to be here." And of course, it was mine. He was really bad.
And how many years were you there?
It's only a one-year program. Yeah, one of the main attractions. It turned journalists out in 8 months.
Well, during the year you were there, did you sports writing that, in other words?
Yeah, what happened was, Ellie Abel was the dean of the law school, and at the time everybody wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein, and investigative journalism was, you know, the rage.
Right.
So just to be ornery and different, I decided to write my master's essay, which was to say a very long magazine piece on Red Smith. Mm-hmm. And I called up Red Smith, who knew me not at all, and explained what I wanted to do. And of course, every kid in America who wanted to be a sports writer had at one point called Red Smith and said, "Gee, can I write about you? Can I come talk to you?"
What
and
paper was he with?
These are the Times. And he said to me, with the voice that he would often describe as the croak of an old croc, "Well, I think it's kind of boring, but if you want to do it, it's okay by me." And so I spent about 6 months trailing him around from stadiums to India to, you know, fights to whatever, watching what he did, and by the time that was done, I knew I wanted to be a sports writer.
Now, this was around 76?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, at that time, were there many or any women sports writers?
No. It was just at the very beginning. There may have been one woman at the New York Times doing hockey. The hockey, interestingly, was the first sport that let women in. Unless you go way back to the 20s, where, you know, some of those real pioneers. But hockey, Robin Herman may have been doing hockey at the New York Times already. Lori Mifflin, the Daily News, was not long thereafter. Baseball was still no way, no how. No football. And I don't think there was any women in professional basketball at all. In fact, Red took me with him to the Immaculate Reception Game, I think it was the Immaculate Reception Game, Pittsburgh that won, Pittsburgh versus the Raiders.
Oh yeah,
and I think it was I think it was January 4th was the date of the fact. It was the one where it was freezing cold, and he'd gotten me credentials that said Red Smith, New York Times, and I thought, this is really totally cool. Of course, they gave him a seat in the heated press box, and I had one in the outdoor auxiliary press box.
Didn't put you on the roof, did they?
No. But being the gentleman that he was, he gave up his seat in the heated press box to sit outside with me. Now, I wasn't dressed for this because I didn't know about sports writer clothes at the time. So along about halftime, he says, I think we should just, let's just watch the game on television. Well, I had no clue. I was so stupid and so young. I had no clue that the senior columnist for a newspaper, much less Red Smith of the New York Times, does not go inside and watch a championship game on television. But that's what we did. And we went inside and watched the second half on television. And at the end of the game, and Pittsburgh had won, all the guys went trooping downstairs to the locker rooms. And so, being what I thought was a good, and do the full reporter, I went along with them. And you know how those corridors and bottoms of stadiums are always narrow. The bigger the players, the more they sort of fill them. And there's the sound of the spikes and the grunts and the... Anyway, these guys all troop off to the to the Pittsburgh dressing room, and I'm left standing outside the Raiders drop dressing room as they come along. The only sound was the sound of Cliff Branch's teeth chattering. And it filed by me and made us left into the locker room. Madden was at the end of the line, and he made a right into the coach's room. And they all just sat there. They were freezing. I mean, they couldn't get undressed.
Well, they were numbed by the outcome, too.
Numbed by the cold. So there's this big, tall Pinkerton guard. I thought he had to be like 6'7", and very skinny. Big, huge Adam's apple. Biggest Adam's apple I've ever seen in my life. And he looks at me, and I look at him. He looks at me, and I look at him. He looks at my credentials hanging on my neck. And I said, ladies, day to day? And he said, and he said, you're with it, Smith. And I said, I tried to be as modest about it as I knew Greg would be. He said, go right in. So I walk in and I make a right and I look at Madden, a huge mound of a man sitting there freezing cold and, you know, just absolutely horrified by this. He's got a big head and a big hand, and he looks up and he sees me standing there and he says, who the fuck is she? And the Pinkerton guard stands up really tall, 6 or 7 of them, and he says, don't worry, Mr. Madden, she's Red Smith. So that's my story. That's my first locker room story, and I was the first woman in the National Football League locker room as a consequence.
Now, the 6 months you were with Red Smith, were you actually employed by the paper? Or?
Oh, no, no. I was a student trailer.
You were like an intern.
It wasn't even that. I was just a freeloader. I was just traveling around asking him urgent questions. He'd be on deadline, sitting there, you know, pecking at the little royal portable. John Stallworth, comma, the, you know, the Pittsburgh receiver, comma, and then you go, and I'd sit there and, you know, poke his elbow and say, now, why did you do it that way? Why didn't you just say the Pittsburgh receiver? I'd be bugging him about sentence structure. And he'd be sitting there, you know, instead of telling me to go to hell, I'm on deadline, he'd just say, well, you know, something in my inner ear tells me that that rhythm is better. And I'd say, oh, thank you very much. Go back to work. So no, I was just a pain in the neck.
Okay, so after the 6 months or so, what happened then?
I graduated. And I got a job at Women's Sports Magazine, spelled lowercase w, uppercase s, one word. It was, at the time, owned by Billie Jean King and her erstwhile husband, Larry. And it was published out of New York.
Larry King, though.
Not Larry King of Brooklyn, no, Larry King of Billie Jean. And post out of New York, and was a monthly, and it was the, you know, it was the beginning of Title IX, Nautilus equipment was brand new. And the idea of women with muscles was still like incredibly threatening to people. And it was owned by Redbook, or sold to Redbook, or some big, huge corporate deal happened. And anyway, by the time I got to my first day of work, everybody had been fired. There was nobody there. There were like a couple of, you know, lower level editors sitting around going, now what do we do? And we ended up hiring our own editor. We went out and found somebody.
Was Billie Jean still at the magazine?
Intermittently, you know, she would sort of waft in and hit imaginary backhand against the art department wall.
Did you get to know her?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I introduced her to Red Smith. They came to dinner one night, and Billie Jean was really insulted that he had never written about her. One, he didn't like tennis, and two, he didn't much like women athletes. So for the combination, there was, you know, what did he care? So I invited them both to dinner, and living on the west side at the time, and I opened the door, and Billie Jean appears resplendent. I mean, decked out like you wouldn't believe. In this long, beautiful burgundy cashmere skirt and pink cashmere sweater and Elsa Coretti diamonds by the yards and these handmade boots with these, you know, fashioned orthotics. And she goes up to Red and she takes his hand and she says, oh, Mr. Smith, I'm so honored to meet you. Red looks at me, like, now what do I do? He just says, well, it's really nice to meet you too. And then he got really shy, and they virtually said nothing to each other the entire meal.
And just you three?
No. It was a woman there who was an editor at Tennis Magazine, I think, at the time, named Susie Adams, who is now an editor at the New York Times Sports Section. My husband was there. Red's wife Phyllis was there. This was a, West Side apartment. We didn't have that big a table.
Is your husband a writer?
No, he's a lawyer.
So, okay, you're with the magazine.
Yeah.
New management. New hiring.
Right. The woman we hired to be our editor eventually became sports editor of the New York Times, the first female sports editor of the New York Times, Dan Schreiber.
And what did you write about? Cover.
I covered tennis, and I covered skating a lot. I edited a lot of different things, but in fact, one my proudest accomplishment was we did an issue called the Tomboy Issue. We went around and we interviewed famous women who had considered themselves in their earlier life to be tomboys. Everybody from Katharine Graham to Zaki Shange, who had written that great play that was on Broadway at the time. He had a ball. It was fun.
Did you do much traveling?
No, we didn't have a budget.
It was pretty much around the year.
Yeah, I went to Philadelphia to interview Dorothy Hamill when she got back from the Olympics. That was probably the biggest story I did. Did a lot of tennis, so I got to know Chris Evert and Tracy Austin and all the players on the tour out at Forest Hills. It was still the tournament, still at Forest Hills. Did some track, some softball, you name it. But the big money sports that I did were the Olympic sports and tennis.
How was the magazine doing?
Terribly. Terribly. In fact, they at Christmas that year, they canceled it. They just, that was it. 2 weeks before Christmas. That's the end of the magazine. And our severance pay, Larry King had invented or patented or whatever a smokeless ashtray, where you put the cigarette in it, there was a little motor that would suck the smoke in, and it was called the No Smoke King, right? We got 2 of those, the severance pay.
This is right before Christmas.
Yeah, right before Christmas.
Okay, so what did you do?
I freelanced, and it's funny, I'm forgetting, I did a bunch of freelancing, because women's magazines were at that point starting to catch on to this new wave of women in sports. They ultimately got a job at a new magazine called Self, which is, become terribly successful. So I was their first sports editor person. And then in 79, my husband moved down here to work, and I got a job at the Washington Post.
Now, up to this time, of course, there were very few women sports reporters. I imagine maybe some sort of discrimination at times, or was there anything that stuck out, or how was it compared to something later?
It wasn't nearly as bad as either people would lead you to believe, or as imagination would create it to be. My first time in a men's locker room, real time, was at a 1978 Knicks game, and I was writing a story for the Daily News Magazine, New York Daily News Magazine, about how jocks had gotten all pretty sissified,
Is that sort of a Sunday?
Yeah,
like the Washington Post magazine.
Yeah, this is the New York Daily News.
Yeah, but I mean it.
Yeah, comparable, sure. And so I went to talk to the Knicks, to talk to Earl Monroe, because Earl Monroe was famous for, his smells. So.
Warmer bullet.
Absolutely. And I walked into the locker room, and I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. And I had my notebook up in front of my nose and my eyes, so I didn't have to look at anything I didn't want to see. And I knew enough by that point, having gotten past the Red Smith debacle in Pittsburgh, not to intrude upon the reporters on deadline. So I was just sort of standing there in the middle of the locker room, not doing anything with my face buried in the notebook, this big, big, wet arm encircles me and says, the voice says, I just want you to know you're doing really well. And I look up and it's Phil Jackson. And this is Phil Jackson, stark naked and sopping wet. And, you know, I sort of went, thank you, you know, and he disappears again. And then he comes back again, puts his arm around me and says, oh, what are you doing here? So I explained about Jack getting all pretty and intensified. And he said, uh-huh. And he goes up to Earl Monroe and he says, yo, Pearl, you got some smells? And he knew that Pearl had lots of smells, because Pearl had a trunk full of smells and of creams and ointments. So Phil began, clearly for my benefit and very kindly, to prance around the New York Knicks locker room, stark naked, spraying himself with every single one of Earl Monroe's smells. And he got all the other guys involved. Ronnie Shelton was there, Jimmy Mack was there. So, I mean, they did this sort of, they acted out my story for me, they handed it to me. So maybe I was spoiled, maybe I was unduly biased by that, but I started out on such a sweet footing that I never expected the worst thing. I was always terribly surprised when it happened. Okay. I did get thrown out of the University of Virginia locker room by a weight coach who picked me up by the scruff of my neck like I was a kid and dropped me outside the front door. What happened?
Okay, so you went to the Washington Post in 79, was it?
Yes, now July 79.
Were you the first woman
to
report to that?
No, there, Joan Ryan had been there and
oh,
had left.
Like Frank Ryan was the quarterback.
Right, exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. A woman named Betty Cunaberry, who had been at the Washington Star, had been there and left. But I believe there was a woman named Nancy Scanlon who did sort of business-related sports stories. I don't know if she was on staff at the same time or if she arrived thereafter, but so no, I was not the first.
One of the first.
Among the first.
Right. Who hired you? Was it the sports department directly or somebody?
Yeah, George Solomon, sports editor at Washington Post.
Still sports
based. He is still sports editor.
Now, when he hired you, what were, did you have specific duties?
I was basically hired, I think, to be a feature type writer and a fill-in, you know, beat writer whenever they needed me. I was the second string baseball writer at the beginning. I was the second string tennis writer at the beginning. I wrote a lot of features, and that was sort of an extra body rather than needed me.
And I guess then you started doing some traveling?
Yeah, majorly. Didn't have kids at the time.
I guess that expense account. How did that work? They got to make the reservations for you?
Oh, no, you make your own arrangements and then you lie about how much it costs. That's a joke. I once actually put in an expense account that was so unfailingly accurate that it was handed back to me by an assistant editor who said that if I submitted that, I would get them all in trouble and to please go rewrite it.
Now, what kind of salary did you get to start?
$19,000.
Was that comparable for a male writer?
I honestly don't know. I didn't ask. I don't know. I mean, I had never worked in a newspaper. So the fact that they hired me all together, they were going to pay me $20,000 was fairly amazing.
Who are some of the other sports writers that were there?
Boswell was there. Ken Dellinger was there. Dave Kindred was there. Michael Wilbon had just arrived right after me.
Was Tony Kornheiser there?
No. Kornheiser was not. Kornheiser was still in New York. He came soon thereafter. Though originally to work for the Style Section, wasn't originally working for sports. Mark Asher was still there.
David Dupree was there.
Dupree was there. Lenny Shapiro was there. Barry Gorge was there. He was the tennis writer.
Right, you remember.
Yeah, he was the guy who was famous for writing 100 inches in every Wimbledon match.
Yes, so you did cover
Steve
tennis.
Steve Hershey was there.
You covered tennis. I always wondered, I mean, I play tennis a lot, I follow it, and I'm always wondering, all the matches are going on, well, a lot of them are going on simultaneously, but still, they manage the main match, or the match that turns out to be the most important of the day, they have quite a bit of detail. And I'm wondering how they go about getting the information, because they could be watching something else, which...
The beginning of a big tournament is unfailingly psychotic in coverage. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, I love tennis, and I play tennis, and I even enjoy writing about it occasionally. But those early days, the U.S. Open in particular, and to a certain extent at Wimbledon, the U.S. Open for sure, you literally roll around like a ping pong ball, you know, bouncing from match to match, because you'd hear out of, you know, somebody else whispering, Martina's down 2-1 on court 27, and you'd tear out there. By the time you got out there, Martina had won the set 6-2. And then you'd hear, back in the stadium, Ash is losing. You'd run back there, you'd go, back there, Ash would be fun. So, you know, catch as catch can, some luck, you know. Obviously, the featured match had a good chance of being your lead. But often there'd be an upset on an outside court, and you got to get your ass out there. And sometimes you miss stuff, and sometimes a friend had to help you out. And sometimes a friend wouldn't help you out. But the early days of the tournament were just killers, particularly with the U.S. Open. They're just such long days.
Okay, so you started with a place in Sanmina.
Correct.
And tell me what you started off with. Did you progress to any, were you a beat writer for anything?
Boz eventually became the national, he probably already was the national baseball writer. In those days in particular, the Post was still sort of schizophrenic about its attitude towards the Orioles. They were not covering them home and away. So Boz was sort of the national writer. He was not a columnist yet. And I did more and more of the home games. Didn't travel too much because they really just didn't want to spend the money and budget on a full-time writer. I mean, you think about it, it was not that many years removed from the Senators having left town. And so there was still this, there's going to be a team here. Not right. So I sort of began to assume those duties. When Lorge left, I became a regular tennis writer. And I covered the Olympics in 76, and then eventually became the chief Olympic writer.
70-something?
Oh, I'm sorry, 70. I apologize, 80. I meant the question. Right.
Winter Olympics.
Yeah.
That was the big hockey. Boy, that was the U.S. beat Russian hockey.
Yeah, I watched it on television in the press room with all these absolutely maniacal Russian writers who were beside themselves, which was much more fun than being in the arena. You know, just like, I mean, pulling the hair, screaming and cursing in Russian. Oi! Ah! It was a great scene.
So how long were you, first did you, Leslie Visser, said you had some connection with her, she was a writer for the Boston.
She was covering tennis, and I guess primarily tennis, but a bunch of stuff. I mean, she was still at the Globe, so we knew each other at tennis tournaments all the time. I have a pretty funny picture of a bunch of us sitting at some restaurant, completely zoned from not having any sleep, like that. I knew her from those days.
Yeah, how long were you with the Post?
I left the Post, well, first of all, I stayed in the sports section until 85, at which point, January 85, I switched over to the style section. It was primarily a decision that I made based on how much I'd been traveling and the idea that if I wanted to have a family, traveling was going to be difficult to keep doing it in that volume. So I switched over to the style section, where I still did a lot of
long sports features. But our first kid arrived in the summer of 85. So I took time off, you know, maternity leave, went back and worked at Style again. And then when the other one, Emma, arrived in 88, basically left the paper for good.
So you're about 7 or 8 years?
No, really.
9 years.
Yeah, no, actually, I think it turned out to be like 10. Yeah.
And what did you do after that?
I wrote a novel called Squeeze Play.
Yeah, don't want to talk to you about that.
Okay.
I was very outrageous.
Did you?
And at the end, I thought, now that you're telling me a few things, I had a hunch. I was going to ask you, is it autobiographical, somewhat? But there's a lot of similarity with what you told me.
No, see, I don't think that it is autobiographical. I think...
Well, your grandmother and New York, near Yankee Stadium.
Well, yeah, I could point you to the pages where those... And I would say that that's the only really autobiographical part of it. I mean, everything else... was either fiction and fanciful, or it was that which was true but you couldn't write in the newspaper. I didn't have the brutally difficult time that the female lead character in that novel has. And she has a much worse time of it than I ever had, A.B. Berkowitz. And it was, to a certain extent, intended to be farce and to be... therefore, somewhat exaggerated.
But not
necessarily where you might assume. I mean, the logical places that people think, oh, that never happened, you know, or this has to be, they're always wrong. You know, I mean, you know, somebody really did microwave a cat, my experience. So, I think of that book as a love story, by the way, which. You know, it's something I've said before, and people laugh at me, but it is a love story about a woman's love for baseball, and that certainly, you know, A.B. and I had in common. But the narrative, you know, is, while it takes the form of a year covering a lousy expansion baseball team in Washington, D.C., which we've never been lucky enough to get. You know, the narrative thrust is really that this woman goes into a man's world with a certain set of expectations and assumptions, and little by little, game by game, day by day, they get stripped away until, you know, she sees these guys who had been her heroes and, you know, Mount Olympus, for whom and for what they really are. But what they are is basically fallible and human, just like that Mickey Mantle. I mean, and A.B. comes to accept them and like them for who they are, without the illusions.
Where did you get the idea? The idea of resurrecting the Senators.
It seemed like a logical thing to locate it in Washington. You know, you're writing a novel for the first time, you don't know what you're doing. You figure, okay, I'm going to make my life as easy as I can, so I'll set it in a place I know. So that's, I mean, it's as simple as that.
Okay. A couple things about the book.
Sure.
There were a couple of true things there that...
Like which one?
Okay. Charlie Bowles. There was a player named Charlie Bowles. You had his grandson.
Mm-hmm.
On page 152. I think he struck out.
Uh-huh. But yes, I think that's right.
I checked the baseball encyclopedia.
Yes, I did go through the baseball encyclopedia. Yes, I did.
That's where you picked Charlie Bowles up.
And right? I also hired a guy at the Elias Sports Bureau to do the stats at the back of the book. They're
and I got to tell you about the stats, too.
Okay, go ahead.
D. Kindred, one time in back, one hit, one home run.
Exactly.
At the post.
Yep, I had to give my buddies. And if you look carefully, my son's in there, too. Here, I'll show you. There he is. Nick Isakoff.
Right.
limited. He has a cup of coffee at the end of the season. Yeah, I have a lot of fun making these up. What else did I? Somebody else was real in here. I don't remember who that I went to high school with.
Oh, Ricky.
So I'm at a reunion recently.
Did he appreciate it? Did he know that?
He doesn't know that. the rest of them I made up. But I did have John Lovenbarta, who is still at the Elias Sports Bureau, and I wanted the verisimilitude of having, you know, statistics be as close to what.
Well, how did you send it to me? In other words, how did they come up with the statistics? Did they just made them up? I know Buck Buchanan had a good year.
Buck had a great year. Till the end. Because I was writing it in the form of a diary that a reporter would keep, and because, therefore, in order to maintain the fiction, the verisimilitude in the fiction, I had to be able to say, well, a guy had a bad day, he went 2 for 4, and blah, 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 blah. So we would take the games. I made a chart of the days that the Senators, the fake Senators won and lost, and who did what in the game. And then I would gave the chart to John, and we extrapolated some reality from there.
Okay. Okay. How did the book sell?
It sold well. Sold out the hardcover. It was sold in movies, so it did well.
But they haven't made a movie.
The script is still around. It's available if anybody's interested. The guy who wrote it did a really did a nice job, and he became a friend, which the guy who wrote My Favorite Year, which were my favorite movies, named Norman Steinberg. But, you know, part of what made this work, to the extent that it worked, was the intentional back and forth between, you know, jolting you back and forth between the sacred, if you will, baseball, the sacred baseball, and the profane of baseball. And in order to make it palatable for Hollywood, they took out a lot of the really funny, gross stuff. And without the contrast, doesn't play as well. You need it to go from the guy microwaving a cat in the locker room to, some fabulous out that way, or some, guy's whole career is on the line. So you needed the contrast, and there wasn't. Hollywood didn't allow for so much of that.
Have you written any other books?
I've written another novel, which is called Most Wanted, which I just finished, and I'm now writing a book about Sandy Koufax for HarperCollins.
Is that the one you have the June 1st deadline?
Yeah. Yes. That's the June 1st deadline.
You have a title for you?
I have a title. Whether they'll go along with it, you never know.
Yeah, let me ask you, do they have the final say in the publisher?
I suppose I should look at my contract and answer that question. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Well, how about police? Like,
me. In fact, there was a big panic at the end with this because they discovered that Paul Auster, who's a very well-known novelist who also writes under pseudonym, Mysteries or something, or a pseudonym of Paul Benjamin, had written one of those called Squeeze Play. Well, you can't copyright a title, so we just said screw it and went ahead and called it Squeeze Play anyway. My name for the Koufax book at this point, whether it will stay this way or not, is Past Perfect. In Koufax, colon.
All right, so you wrote your book.
I wrote my
not
book. Not
working for the Post anymore.
Doing
freelance?
I didn't do that much. I mean, I really decided I wanted to do fiction, and I did. So I did that for a while, and I was mom of 2 young kids. So I didn't want to travel. I wanted to be home, and even with magazine stuff, just travel. And I'm married to a litigator. He travels, so there had to be somebody here.
Well, So what are some of the things you wrote in nonfiction? Books or just the articles?
I've done some stuff for on women's sports, some gymnastics stuff for Sports Illustrated, some Olympic stuff for the New York Times, and also a couple pieces for the Post.
Let's see, I got some here. Carrie Strug's Sports Illustrated, August 6, 1997.
Yeah, I did that, right. And then I did a chapter for an anthology about women's sports on gymnastics. I honestly put most of my effort into writing the novel. It was a very deliberate choice.
You have an agent.
Oh, yeah. That's been difficult.
You need to, yes, a writer needs that.
Black ink. He's a great agent.
He also wrote an article, Nike is a Goddess.
Nike is a Goddess is the name of the anthology that I was referring to, which is a collection of different essays by different women writers about specific sports among history of gymnastics. About which I first
don't know. And Nike is a Goddess. I looked it up in
the picture. Yes, Nike is a Goddess. Exactly right.
Never hear that.
Your man, Mark, I wonder if Michael Jordan is that.
What was your most memorable experience as a sports writer?
Most memorable experience as a sports writer.
Else,
it's probably that one that I told you about, Mickey, at the very beginning. Each of us somewhere inside has, an expectation that's either going to be met or not met. And to have this guy who I revered my whole life, stick his hand out and say, "Why do you think I was going to scare us in a pour on your kitty?" It was devastating. I went to my room that night and 3 o'clock in the morning, called my best friend and cried and said, "You won't believe what he said to me." I was devastated. But the next day, I started to see the other side of him. I think a lot of these guys, particularly of that era, acted the way they thought they were expected to act. So Mickey Mantle was supposed to be a lecherous drunk, so he acted the part of a lecherous drunk. You're supposed to, you're supposed to hit on everybody. So you hit on everybody, and then you tell them, "Forget it, go away, I'm not interested," and they go, "Oh, okay, never mind. No big deal." I found him eminently likable, funny. This is a man who was, he talked about his dreams. This guy should have been in psychotherapy. His dreams were fabulous, and he would talk about them all the time. Tell me about the famous one that he told a lot, frequently told about how he was going to Yankee Stadium and Bob Shepard would be announcing the batting order, and you could hear his voice from the outside trying to get in, and all the fences would be locked and all the gates would be locked, and he'd be standing outside, rattling the chain, "Let me in!" And you could hear, "Now batting number 7, let me in!" Which is a great one. But my favorite one they told me was that he was pole vaulting. And he's running down the runway or whatever you call it, and he's up in the air, and suddenly, oh my God, he's falling. Well, what a better way, could an unconscious describe what it must be like to go from being top of the world, Mickey Mantle, to being old, hobbled, arthritic, and needing a job at a casino in order to pay your kids' medical bills. It was the perfect,
you know, statement of what it's like to go, you know, from the top of fame on down. And I, you know, this was a man who was in touch with his unconscious.
In your opinion, who are some of the best sports writers today?
I wish that Dave Kindred were still writing for a daily newspaper.
He went to Kentucky, didn't he?
He went to Atlanta. He was with Atlanta for a while. Then he went to the National in that brief period when they tried to get that off the ground and it didn't work, whatever that was, a year or so. He went back to Atlanta. He writes a lot of golf now, and I believe he does an online daily column or 6 days a week for Sporting News. But as a pure writer and somebody whose language I love and whose instincts about sports and ethics I revere, he would be my all-time favorite. I think Michael Wilbon at the Post has developed into a fabulous columnist. He's just amazingly good, and I remember when he was just a scared kid. First day he showed up for work.
From Chicago.
I mean, I love when Boz writes about baseball, and I don't think he does it enough. I think some of the women, particularly the New York Times, really good beat writers. Selena Roberts is really good. It's embarrassing to admit this, but I read the New York Post because it reminds me of my childhood. Is it well written? No. Is it everything that, the Washington Post and the New York Times aren't in terms of sports coverage? Sure. So I read it and I enjoy it, but it's not great stuff. George Vesey is a wonderful man and a wonderful writer, and he always comes to things with a different take. Lipsyte's terrific, and always, got an edge that nobody else has. I'm sure there are a zillion people that I'm not thinking of.
How do you hear about Saber?
I think I was born in
Well, you just joined Ringwell in the last year or so.
Yeah, I did join just in the last year or so, and that's my fault. That was really stupid. It's like saying, how did you know how to ride a bike? I don't remember when you didn't know about Saber.
Started in 71.
Well,
but of course it was just a small group of six.
Dave, you stumped me. I don't remember. I don't know. But
glad to have you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be had. It's I can't believe what's happened to the Baltimore Orioles. It's unbelievable.
Started with John Miller.
It did start with John Miller. You're exactly right. I ran into him at the airport a couple of years or so ago, and we just looked at each other and went, What can you say? It's so sad. I don't know what I'm going to do for baseball this year. I gave up my tickets. Can't do it. So they may be more interesting if any of the kids, if any of us are kids come out. But I still got a long way to go on the pro festival.
It will
keep me busy. And he's a wonderful man. And I'm really...
Have you talked to him about the book?
He clearly was not thrilled with me doing it, and it wasn't the me part of it. He just didn't want anybody to write anything about him, I don't think. But as I've come to know him, both through interviewing and to the extent that I've gotten to talk to him, become very clear to me that this is a really extraordinary human being. He may have been a great pitcher, but he's a really good guy. And he makes it very clear, and I have accepted his terms. It's not
not a ghostwritten book, it's not his book, it's my book. He's not endorsing it particularly, he's not, you know, telling me what's right and what I can write and what I can't write, but he has been willing to, answer questions about fact and say, you know, yes, this is true, no, that's not true, blah, 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 blah. That's really good. Emma, he's not here. And I think he has really an enduring legacy. Not that he planned or wanted or intended. Yeah.
So, assuming the book is, you get it to the publisher by the 1st of June,
mm-hmm.
when would it be out?
I think that they want to publish it.
Would you?
No. I wanted to publish it on the book. I thought it would be
That's
great.
Right.
I thought it would be great. Have every rabbi in the country standing outside every temple. They buzz, but no. I think they want to publish it around Father's Day. I think they think it's a
second
good
week of June. Third week of June.
Be a good, you know, make a good gift book kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think maybe in the baseball, you know, of course it depends on what type of other books are out too. You know, I guess you look at the Sabre Bulletin
mm-hmm.
when it comes. It seems that at least half the baseball books, maybe more, are published by Sabre members, or written by Sabre members. You notice that? In other words, in the bulletin.
Well, I think the books that are mentioned in the Sabre Bulletin are disproportionately written by Sabre members. I'm not sure that if you could, you might be able to get a computer printout of every baseball book written every year. I don't know whether that, you know, what
well,
percentage
certainly
would be.
Good proportion.
Yeah, yeah. It's a tough gig. Tough getting published, and it's tougher writing. You know what Red Smith used to say about it? His famous line is, oh, writing is easy. You just take out a vein and let the blood drop out, drip by drip. Yeah, I know. Now I know what he's talking about.
Is it going to be the same publisher as Squeeze Play?
No. Squeeze Play was Doubleday, and this is HarperCollins.
Same agent for both?
No, I switched agents. The people who represented me on this were they were more literary agents, literary, quote-unquote, agents. David Black has done numerous in sports and nonfiction. So, yeah, he's good. He's really good. And it was funny. I wasn't a Koufax fan growing up. I was a Yankee fan.
Sure.
I hated. You know, I mean, one of the things I've written is, you know, I was probably the only Jewish kid growing up in New York who wasn't a Koufax fan.
But of course, when you were a Yankee fan, Koufax wasn't that time. He may have been on the Dodgers, I think, just before they left Brooklyn.
My,
he left, but
well,
he got his, I mean, his successful years were really in
California. Sure, no,
the
Yankees right.
Weren't quite that time.
Well, how about 63?
Well, that's Koufax.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, the Concourse Plaza Hotel, where Babe Ruth used to stash his babes, where the visiting teams used to stay when they came to play the Yankees at Yankee Stadium, the 161st and Grand Concourse. Every fall, they had the high holy day services in the ballroom, because the synagogue that my grandmother belonged to was too small. And so they'd take over the ballroom, and it was a conservative synagogue, which meant that the women and the men sat separately. No, separately.
Oh, conservative?
Conservative meant separately.
No, that's true, conservative.
Well, this was old conservative. And so, which was great for my benefit, from my point of view, because that meant I was higher up. And the ballroom had fabulous, thick, long, heavy velvet, you know, brocade curtains, and I would just hide in them and watch the ball game. I mean, my grandmother was, you know, there's a line in here, you know, you're not supposed to quote yourself, it's really tacky, but
she did love her grandchildren more than she loved God. And she snuck me into that synagogue with my Sammy Esposito blog and my transistor radio. And if she had to pray a little louder to cover Mel Allen's voice and make sure I didn't get caught, she did. And, you know, what could you see from that window? Not very much, you know. Hector Lopez floating in the outfield, you know, dropping a ball, whatever.
The World Series came at the wrong time.
Well, it came at the right time for 64, but 1957, Dodgers last year in Brooklyn, my father, who grew up on Coogan's Bluff, and was a great Giants fan, took my sister, who hated sports and hated baseball, to Ebbets Field so that she could see the Dodgers before they left town. And they didn't take me with them. And I remember the indignation. I remember standing. I remember I got stung by a bee that day. I was really pissed. And I was in the backyard, pissed off. How fast pitched up there? And they brought me a baseball cap, but it was a feminized version of a baseball cap. So it had a wider brim and an inset panel with white and blue. It was just like a girly thing, you know. It wasn't real. And they brought me this thing, and that was it. As far as I was concerned, there was no way I was ever going to be any kind of a Dodger fan. Forget it. So Koufax was like, who needs him? Whitey, come on. Whitey was my dad. So I did not come to this project with a bias. In fact, I came with it with, well, I did come with bias. It was an anti-bias, a disinterest. I mean, I really didn't, you know, I just didn't care. I mean, it didn't do anything for me. And I was wrong. Learned a lot. That was it. Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal.
Do you have an idea
how long it's going to be? Oh, I think it's supposed to be 300, you know, or under 300. It's not intended, it's not going to be the Joe DiMaggio one. I'm not doing the Richard Ben Kramer. Kramer took, what, 5 years to write that? Something like that? No, this is not going to be a Joe D effort, either in length or I have a friend, a dear, dear friend, who said to me, she's very smart, she doesn't care about sports at all, and she knows nothing, and occasionally I say to her, come on, let me take you to baseball game, just for the hell of it. She says, and she said to me, what a treat to be able to write about someone you actually like. And this is when I knew nothing about him. somehow she knew, and it's true, it's an interesting dilemma because we live in a time where, much as people protest to the contrary, you know, people say they want to read nice things, but then, you know, they look for the dreck. So I don't know what happens when you write a nice book about somebody. We'll find out, won't we? We'll find out.